Thank you very much for inviting me. It's really good to be here. One of the things I do is I'm a kind of observer of society, not in a terribly professional way, just as an amateur, really. And I find that films are a fascinating kind of comment on society, and that there are all sorts of things you can learn from films. And here are a few things. If you're a visitor in a strange city, there are some things from films that will actually really remarkably encourage you. I don't know if you've noticed this, but in a film, if you've had a taxi ride, when you're paying for your taxi, you don't actually need to look in your wallet to decide what notes you're going to take out to pay. Just grab anyone at random, and it's bound to be right. It's really quite interesting. I don't know how they do that. The other thing, which is quite gratifying in a big city, which is always true in films, you can always park directly outside the building that you're visiting. And also a label appears to tell you where it is. It's extremely useful. I just wish, you know, everyone could be hardwired that way. It'd be great. And I think the best thing of all is, you know, if it all goes wrong and nobody likes what you're saying and they actually want to chase you out of town, well, the wonderful thing is that you can always take refuge in a passing St. Patrick's Day parade, which miraculously will actually be true on whatever day it is that you're visiting the city. And if anyone can work out how all that works, well, that'd be really great. I happen to share the view of the Archbishop of Canterbury, it's always a good name to drop, that we live in perhaps the most creative time that's happened for several hundreds of years over thinking about what church is. My guess and my understanding is as the 21st century unrolls, our questions about this have actually become more searching and more foundational because both of a raft of external contextual changes, but also because of creativity within the church. Here then are some of the external reasons that have overtaken us as it's occurring to us on our side of the pond. And all the way through, you must be making comparisons and saying, where is this also true for us? Where is simply the English story different? Here's one of them. Nearly all institutions are now regarded in our society with some suspicion. Now that makes the past dominant model of church as institution, with somewhat ponderous structures, emphasis on buildings, and almost a separate caste of clergy, rather unconvincing to many people. With also a burgeoning interest in a whole variety of spiritualities, church, if you like, is seen as foundering in some kind of muddy backwater of just religion. We're thought to be into repression of feelings, though not over some issues, concern with outward form, and perhaps instincts to control others. Perhaps that's the most worrying. The third factor might be this. Cultural and intellectual pluralism, together with a very high view placed on tolerance of other people's views, is making obsolete any concept that any one size of church can fit all. I don't know whether you'd agree with the next one, but some of us think that consumerism is possibly the most dominant force in Western society. And that has injected a questionable high level of choice into church affiliations. It's increased the transfer rate between them. It may even have changed committed members into worship tasters. And then there's also the dissolving of Christendom and the rise of a society based on networks, which has led to a double sense of liminality, a word I relearned from a Canadian, and you'll probably know which one. And by that word liminal, I mean going through what is both a threatening but also a promising transitional stage beyond an old certainty. And that liminality is characterized by the church both being at the edge of society as opposed to being at its center, and it's also about existing in a world that may not actually have centers at all anymore. Very different from our territorial instincts based on place. At this point, I notice a few of you are scribbling, and that's tremendously gratifying. Please continue to do it. But what I should have told you at the beginning is, if you want the whole of this text on a memory stick afterwards and the PowerPoint, that can all be electronically done, so scribble for your pleasure, but there are other ways you could get your information. Don't let the flow of it overwhelm you. The man who's prophetically dropped his pencil is to be congratulated. So there are some things from outside. I think also there are some changes from within, which I believe, and I can't say I know, I can only believe this, they've arisen not so much because of external changes in society. I actually believe they have their genesis in the creativity of the missionary Holy Spirit. Now, I'm not saying to you that each of those new developments is perfect or that it's above criticism. I'm making a much more modest point that despite our muddles and our imperfect experimentation, God is at work amongst us, and I rejoice in it. And then I noticed the following. The creation of fresh expressions of church, and indeed that very language that we can talk like that, has prompted new questions about what church is. And what's so interesting and important, crucially, is that those questions are unanswerable simply by using the skills of how to sustain existing churches. And nor are they very much helped by talk of how to increase the size of existing forms. Now, some of those examples are fresh expressions of church, say, for example, like Cell Church and its derivatives, or the equally recent but growing group of people who have what Alan Jameson calls a churchless faith, point up very sharply that some assumptions about church are just that. Sacred buildings, congregations, paid and ordained ministers are no longer seen as essential to being church. Now, not all agree with that view, but at least the question has been lodged. And then there is the sheer variety of fresh expressions, and indeed the inherent provisionality and partial character of the very phraseology expression, that has further opened up another realization. No one expression of church is complete, and none of them, whether emerging church or inherited church, can fully represent Christ, whose body the church is supposed to be. Again, I very much appreciate the work of Archbishop Rowan, and again, this is one of his. I'll read it because there's a tape and some people may only get it that way. I know you can read it on the screen better than I can do it. If Christ is the embodiment of God and the church is his body on earth, then no single expression of church can ever exhaust Christ. Now, that's very interesting. In that sense, no local church is completely church. It is only an expression of church. So then we find ourselves in a time when the question, what is church, is more live than for a very long time. I want to suggest to you that's actually quite helpful in our mission context of needing to plant fresh expressions of church. For the worst thing that we could do would be simply to replicate the expressions of being church that have partly led to our problem in the first place, and which only appeal to the current dwindling insiders. And at the same time, we actually need some clarity about what church is, for otherwise we won't know what to plant. So in this context, people have turned to the analogy of the DNA of church. Now, they may mean quite different things by it, and I'm going to use the two talks in this conference to explore what I take to be the two most helpful meanings of the analogy. So here's the first. It's using the analogy of DNA to try to isolate the essence of church. People are reaching out for ways to talk about its essence that goes behind any specific form to try to identify, well, what's generic about this. So this talk of DNA means the search try to encapsulate a sort of irreducible essence or minimum that does need to be reproduced so that what is reproduced deserves being called church. Now, that use of DNA, I think, appeals to a search for a kind of more portable minimalism, as well as yardsticks to assess any expression of church. Now, I think that's what's at best about it. At worst, it might turn out to be a kind of illusory search for simplistic answers to what is undoubtedly a complex reality. So I don't know if you know this aphorism, I must confess I like it. Simplicity on the near side of complexity is useless. Simplicity on the far side of complexity is priceless. So at best here, I think, is a search for ways to talk about church that are meaningful, accessible, and useful for today's mission context. That's what we're going to be doing tonight. The second way to look at DNA is to talk about it as the mechanisms by which something is reproduced. That's an analogy in itself, but it's fair to the DNA analogy, a legitimate question. That's what we're going to talk about tomorrow. Let's then press on with this first one. What, then, is to be planted or reproduced? I want to begin by saying I detect in the United Kingdom, and I simply don't know what's true here, I simply am telling you what we are finding. There are perhaps two equally flawed positions in seeking to understand this, which we need to avoid, a kind of Scylla and Charybdis, if you're up with Greek mythology. One set of distortions, I would want to say, is not sufficiently ecclesial. And on the other side, some are blatantly not missional. And I'm wanting to say neither of those will do. So then there are, I suggest, two distortions to avoid. No particular order to these. I think I feel equally critical of both. One, I think, is almost an undue emphasis on the gospel. Now, in some contexts, that's almost an unbelievable statement. And you say, I wouldn't care having any amount of it because there's simply none here. Well, I do understand. However, I do have to tell you, some people do overbalance in that direction. Let me explore it with you. Some evangelists are guilty of this. I work for the Church Army in England, which is a society of evangelists. So in a sense, I sometimes live among this. And this is what I call the Jesus is great, too bad that the church is poo, kind of approach. And a little more theologically, perhaps, it's a view that the gospel changes lives, and then the church is just a kind of tub in which you'd keep that. It's a bit like the popcorn approach. I mean, you know, you go to the cinema, you want a tub of popcorn. You're not really interested in the tub, you just want the popcorn. That kind of view. It's a view, if you like, that focuses on the harvest and at the same time complains about the barns. It's a picture that sort of says, well, you know, the gospel is the active ingredient and the church is passive. It's just like a lump of grey in a dough. That kind of view. It's a view that says we plant gospel and we reap church. Now, interestingly, it colludes quite nicely with the view that mission precedes church. Now, in the story of the New Testament, it's true historically the mission of Jesus had to occur before the church of Jesus appeared. So there's some evidence to support such a view. Now, you're suspecting a but and you won't be disappointed. However, let me just give you the polar extreme. At the other end of the spectrum, I want to suggest to you, we have seen some people overemphasize church. And in such an environment, in such a worldview, creating fresh expressions really becomes not much more than improving an existing worship service. Or perhaps offering another worship service in the same ecclesial location. And this seems to me, frankly, not very much more than the very fading actress pushing putting on some lipstick and hoping she's going to attract some new fame and suitors and so forth. Sorry, is that your grandmother? Right. And worse than that, I think, in a sense, it assumes that church attendance by outsiders is in itself the name of the game. And what's happening, I think, is that the Cyprianic view, he who would have the church as his father, must have God as his father, must have the church as his mother. And the view there is no salvation outside the church, in a sense, that has been co-opted in an unhelpful, ecclesiocentric view. Why are these distortions and what are their dangers? Let's go there. The view that only gospel is needed, I suggest to you, is blind to the realization that there is no such thing as the disincarnate gospel. The gospel always has a bearer who is part of the church. And indeed, its embodiment in people is a key part of the witness to the gospel. Now, what's really interesting, we're finding in the United Kingdom that those communities who by their life together demonstrate the life of Jesus are those which pose helpful questions to surrounding society and then draw people to Jesus. You may have heard this statement before. See how these Christians love one another is the gospel embodied. Now, the danger also of an overemphasis on gospel, and we've seen this also in church planting, is it leads to unsustainable activism, to leaders driving congregations, I have to say often through guilt, to the point where the people either rebel or resign or just curl up their toes in exhaustion. Now, beneath all that, I believe what it is doing, it is confusing the growth of the church with the purpose of the church. And it becomes really rather like the odd situation of a couple only getting married in order to have children. Now, I would want, therefore, quite seriously to argue, mission actually is not the identity of the church, though it is in its DNA. Let's flip the picture and look at the other side. The over-churchy view is dire for quite other reasons. In such places, and you may have seen them, you will find a distortion in which you will find, well, the person of Jesus, frankly, is seldom mentioned. Because certainly in a British context, that would be far too personal and embarrassing. And the idea of the church as a countercultural force engaging with society is also missing. And discipleship involving a changed life, well, that's not talked about either. So, as opposed to activism, the danger is quietism. As opposed to existing for others, the danger is that these churches exist for themselves, whereby worship and pastoral care become everything. Well, yes, such things are in the DNA of church, but they too are not its identity. So, what is the way forward? In church planting, it really matters what we think we are planting, because the really worrying reality is that we can reproduce our own distortions of church. So therefore, let me suggest to you a better way. And I suppose I've always thought that the language of church planting actually should help us here. For here we meet two words, church and plant. The first is very obviously ecclesial, and planting rightly sounds pretty missional. And I want to suggest to you that church and plant, ecclesial and missional, are not just like, I gather you do pancakes and maple syrup. I haven't actually been there, but it sounds good. I want to suggest to you that church and plant, ecclesial and missional, are more than pancakes and maple syrup. I suggest to you that actually they are more like this, chicken and egg. And you know how it goes. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Very hard to say which came first. Let's explore that. Well, yes, historically, as I've already confessed to you, the mission of Jesus led to the church. That's true. But ever after, I suggest to you, they are intertwined. Church is the foretaste of God's ultimate purposes. And that is what gospel produces. And yet, it's also true, people made alive by encounter with Christ in such a way that the way they relate to one another has changed and shows the life of Christ, well, that embodies gospel and bears it to others. Could it be the case, exploring DNA tonight, that church and gospel are a little bit like a helix, interweaving, with one side perhaps more visible at particular moments, but both essentially needing each other? Now, that need for connection, I think, was very graphically put over 50 years ago by one of the great missionary statesmen of the 20th century, whom I take to be Leslie Newbegin. Look at his words. An unchurchly mission is as much a monstrosity as an unmissionary church. And note his words. The word monster is language that we use for something which has been created that has gone badly wrong. Frankenstein is alive and well and living in the church, seems to be the problem. And I've shown you perhaps what some of those distortions look like. But I want to go further because I think there are even deeper reasons why the two, church and mission, must coexist. I want to suggest to you that we best come to know what church is, that is, the people of God, the body of Christ, the temple of the Spirit, by what God the Spirit, the Son and the Father, the Trinity, are. Now, that was hinted at in the theology of mission-shaped church, which John kindly presented and improved, thank you, last year. Let me put it for you a slightly different way this year. As I've thought about it more, it seems to me rather odd that though Eastern theologians such as Zizioulas for many decades have been insisting that we think of God as communion or community more than singularity, that's been their contribution. At the same time, some Western theologians, say like Barth or Bosch, for a similar length of time have been recovering for us the missionary character of God. It just seems to me that it's time to insist that these two hitherto rather disconnected streams of honourable thought should be brought together and indeed must belong together. Thus, I'm finding it both helpful and persuasive to speak about God the Trinity as community in mission. Now, I'm entirely serious about the order of these three words. Community is quite deliberately put first. Missional community would be an alternative term. I just think it's not quite so good. And here are a few reasons why. The Godhead existed in loving community, I suggest to you, before the mission began. Though mission was the natural overflow of their loving life. For being is always deeper than doing. And identity is in some senses prior to activity. Thus, communal love comes before missional purpose. Now, it's then interesting, I want to suggest to you, we see the same in Jesus. He came from the Trinitarian community before his mission unfolded. So the old mission comes before church because Jesus' mission comes before the appearance of church is actually not adequate as an argument. And Jesus' identity preceded his activity. He was God the Son in the manger before he had done anything at all. God the Father expressed his approval of his Son at his baptism before the public ministry began. Jesus himself then chose his symbolic characteristic followers before, frankly, they were of much use. I wonder if you've ever noted the order that comes in Mark chapter 3 and verse 13. He calls to him those he wanted, he appointed 12. Note these words, that they might be with him and that he might send them. What an interesting order. So I, for those reasons, want to suggest to you that community in mission is a better order of words to speak of the Trinity. Their mission in Jesus embodies the same order. I'd want to suggest, therefore, that sets a pattern for the church. So I'm about to answer my question after about 20 minutes, typical court of preacher. What then is being planted? It is, I think, this Jesus-centered community in mission. So, for example, compare how that shapes up with the kind of definition that we coined after a certain amount of graft in the Mission Shaped Church report of 2004. Here's the definition. I'll comment. Church planting is the process by which the seed of the life and the message of Jesus, which sounds pretty much to me like gospel, embodied in a group of Christians, well, that sounds pretty much to me like church, is immersed for mission reasons, do note that when the motivation questions come up, in a particular cultural or geographic context. The intended consequence, it comes to root there, coming to life as a new indigenous body of Christian disciples. Well, sounds pretty ecclesial. Well suited to continue in mission. Well, that's obviously missional. But what might such a community look like? What will it do? How will we know it's church? Well, I think you've deserved a break. I'm going to now and see whether technology will support us at this point, so I'm going to play you a DVD clip of a particular fresh expression from England.
Pal Singh realised there was a real need for a new kind of church for British Asians living in Birmingham, one that was not too Asian and yet not too Western. Now a small group meets weekly to study the Bible and pray together, and in a way that is culturally comfortable.
I think people sometimes from other faiths find it very threatening to go into a church building. They don't know what to do. Should I sit down? What should I do? Should I stand here? We wanted to create something which was non-threatening, which wasn't seen as just the white man's faith, his religion, and to be able to say that it's okay, it's fine to be a follower and a disciple of Christ without losing your cultural identity. So we wanted to create something where people from those different faiths could see that Christ wasn't just somebody which was for the Western society, but it was somebody that they could identify from the East as well. Maybe they decided to follow Christ and they went to a church. What they discovered was that was basically two meetings a week, and what they were looking for was family. They were looking for community. And so in Sanctuary, we've sought to create something and build that so that when you come into Sanctuary, there's some refreshments, there's sofas, there's somewhere on the floor, and it's, you could talk. And at the end, there's Asian food to enjoy over conversation. That's just part of being family. That's part of being community. And also sharing our lives during the week and doing a number of social events and other things together as well.
I started coming to Sanctuary about 5 years ago. I was probably searching for something that was actually missing out of my life. we actually have somebody actually lead the service for about half an hour, 45 minutes, and then we actually conclude with meditation. If we need to be prayed for on an individual basis, that's also offered to us as well. Depending on what background you do actually come from, it can be difficult in that sense. But it is a very safe place, and that's something that's always highlighted for people that do actually come for the first time.
We've learned that, you know, when you start something, it's a lot of hard work and it takes ages. And I would say don't give up, persevere. We're still discovering new things that we need to do in terms of reaching and connecting with the Asian community and for the Asian community to connect with God, with Christ. And that's the space that we're creating, that personal space for people to have. I think it's very, very important that when you're doing something like this, which is at times very much out of the box, it's not just thinking in the box, thinking at times there is no box, and you're taking risks, you're taking steps of faith, you're pioneering into new ground, as it were, and it's perseverance, but it's important that you partner with other groups. We need one another on this journey. That we realize that there's music, there's drama, there's videos and all kinds of other stuff that we can tap into and support and help one another along this journey.
Clip later. The danger of sharing one clip is that people who are anxious to do the right thing sometimes say, "Oh, that's what I should do." So in a way, I deliberately showed you the one actually you'd be least likely to copy. Because actually we've got to get a lot more cute about this and go, well, so that, which wasn't in our majority culture, how would you know whether it was church or not? Those are the kind of questions that we're going to be facing more and more. So let's begin to explore that a bit more. How will we know whether it's church? I have to confess to you that my knowledge of the science of DNA is probably entirely limited to a rather enjoyable reading of Bill Bryson's book, A Short History of Nearly Everything. Now, the entertaining thing about that is that only a fortnight ago, I was in Switzerland skiing, so I'm presently enjoying your snow. I'm sorry it's not true for you. And another member of the very same hotel was Bill Bryson. So that was really odd to be sitting down at breakfast and thinking, Bill Bryson is on the next table, and I mustn't talk to him because he's so famous, he must be so bored of people coming up and saying, "Are you Bill Bryson?" But anyway, I learned from Bill Bryson that, and that's all I know about it, so I'm terribly sorry. DNA apparently has got four chemical components. I don't even know I'm going to pronounce them right, but I'm going to go for adenine, sounds like someone's fourth daughter, guanine, cytosine, thiamine. Is that kind of 60%? Okay, right. And what is interesting about these four is apparently they are four very common substances. And guanine and seagulls, I can get there. Now, the genius apparently is not in some highly specialized existence or one or more of them. The genius of the whole thing is in the way that they interlink. The particular way in which they pair in the now famous double helix. Now, I'll tell you this for nothing. I am not the author Dan Brown of Da Vinci Code fame. So I'm not entirely serious in suggesting to you that these four chemicals are actually secret code now you won't tell anybody this, will you? Because I shall get into dreadful trouble and newspapers want to interview me, and I'm not good at that. I just find it amusing that classically there are four marks of the church. What's interesting is, at least in some Anglican circles, the four dynamics are being taken as DNA-like components of what do need to be reproduced in any further expression of church. Now, last year, part of John's unenviable task was to give you my brief mapping of these four historic marks of the church, one, Holy, Catholic, and Apostolic, onto the directions and the labels of some simpler words, up, in, out, and of, and here's that diagram by way of reminder. What I want to do this evening is push that a bit further, not least in terms of Bryson's point that it is the interlinking between the four which is crucial. Now, there are some things which are pleasant about that diagram. It's cross-shaped. Christians seem to like that. It also suggests, by the way the diagram works, here are four key roles of the church which are distinct, and they all matter. Mission, then, is no substitute for worship, and vice versa. And belonging in one congregation is no substitute for having a wider identity with the rest of the church, and so on. The diagram also suggests there's a center in which all of these four directions meet. You could call that, in terms of tonight's presentation, being Jesus-centered, and that church is community-centered in Jesus. That's simply what it is from which all these directions need to be explored. I'm wanting to suggest to you now, and I hope this doesn't blow your minds, there is another shape, a pyramid, three-sided, in this case, that does some of the other work that I want to suggest to you we need to do. Now, for those of you who are mathematical, you will have recognized immediately this is a regular tetrahedron. The rest of you can forget that. But it has, apparently, a number of other virtues. Now, unlike the cross shape, and we'll just briefly go back there with the four directions, the directions go in very different ways, so they only meet at the center, and only some of them are next to the others. And I began to think that was a problem. So I got a bit of blue tack and started to play with a shape until I found something that did some different work. And in this shape, every one of them is profoundly connected to all of the others. And I want to suggest to you it's actually more like that in genuine church life. So the mission, for example, needs to be sustained by the community. It needs to be energized by its meeting with God in worship and supported by the wider church. Or take another example. The worship is itself fed by resources from the wider church. That's, in one sense, what prayer books are about. It needs also, very importantly, to spring out of the ongoing life of the particular community, and it should be in conversation with its mission. Too often that connection's not a strong one. So the four, it seemed to me, are almost more like dimensions, not just directions. And they are far more interrelated than the simple fourfold directions diagram visually suggests. That's one virtue. There is, I think, another virtue that however you look at that shape, and I've needed to do it therefore with dotted lines, there is some element that actually you cannot see. That reminds me that the church will always defeat our attempts to fully describe her. There will always be that sense of mystery. Now, that's partly because the church on earth is herself only partly what she's called to be. She is the bride, awaiting consummation. The temple, not yet in New Jerusalem. The new Israel, not yet in the promised land. The people on pilgrimage. Now, the New Testament testifies to this mystery by never fully defining the church. How terribly annoying. And uses simply a riot of images to describe her. I think the best book on that is Paul Manier's book of the 60s, Images of the Church. Or Dulles' Models of the Church. But Manier, I think, is more evocative. And that will, if you go to one of those, help you encounter again what this sense of mystery is and how essential it is. And of course, the church must be a mystery because she was called into being by grace. And which one of us knows exactly how grace works? She is indwelt by the Spirit. And there's a constant source of disturbance and surprise. And it's described as the body of Christ, an image which in the one hand is desperately familiar, and yet the more you ponder such a phrase, the body of Christ, the more elusive and mind-boggling it becomes. So, my good friend, I wish that were true, Pope Paul VI, said at Vatican II, when I was barely drawn and thought of, the church is a mystery. There's a reality imbued with the hidden presence of God. It lies therefore within the very nature of the church to be always open to new and ever greater exploration. What words of promise. So I want to push these four marks out a bit further. Not, I hasten to add, as a demanding measurement which will condemn what other people may have done so far in a church plant or fresh expression, but perhaps as what a group centering in Jesus might want to aspire to. I also want to explore them in pairs because it's quite clear that the four marks derive their meaning and their dynamism not so much by being utterly separate from each other, but because of their interconnection. So let's go there. Apostolic. I've looked at how a number of current thinkers are understanding the apostolic. And I suggest what is being held in common across them. This is actually a dimension of the church that connects across time and yet stays faithful. It looks back to its origins in God, Christ, and Scripture that give it authenticity and authorization. It also looks forward with a kind of missionary momentum from that very past. So apostolicity is concerned with how foundational values are faithfully transferred, whether in human lives, by doctrine, by ordinations, or indeed all of them. But by it, the church is also called to look forward through mission to what is not yet, sending members out and beyond into the world and into the future. And that journey will take it to fresh locations, though today those locations sometimes will be defined by culture, not just by territory. However, being apostolic is more than an existing ecclesial community learning to face outwards. It includes some members leaving and starting a fresh community elsewhere. Why am I so sure? Because that's what happened with the Trinity shown in the Incarnation and Christ calling disciples. Now, funnily enough then, planting fresh expressions of church by reproduction is closer to the divine pattern than many attractional mission practices of existing churches, let alone the barely missional existence of many churches, for whom apostolicity is all about authenticity from past links. And then reproduction, by definition, leads to the birth of related but non-identical churches. And here, the apostolic note or mark cannot alone encompass that. Principled diversity, by which there can be churches that remain apostolic in faithfulness and yet differ from inherited patterns needs engagement with what does it mean to be one and what does it mean to be Catholic. So let's go to Catholic. This is, in effect, I think, a complementary relationship to apostolic. And Catholic is concerned for that dimension by which the Church exists and connects across space and across difference. It seeks to express the wholeness of the Church in each place through insisting on an enduring connection between twin callings, universality and particularity, but without the universal degenerating into uniformity. And I'll come back to that. So Catholicity enshrines that all Christians are in relational connection. Now that repudiates us seeing ourselves primarily as individual Christians or even independent churches. Relational connection with others who are to some extent unlike us is what actually gives us identity as persons. You know who you are partly by knowing your parents. And you are, when a child, very glad that you are not your parents. We see that in the family. But of course, there's a deeper model. Our model for that is not primarily family life. The model is the diverse, yet united, loving community of the Trinity. So equally, each person is God. Yet there's that. Also that diagram that says, and the Father is not the Son. And the Son is not the Spirit. Connectivity is also with the communion of saints. But ultimately, there's one church, and there's going to be one new heaven and earth. And connection with others also then informs mission to others, so that the Christian faith may be more universal in geographical scope, and yet remain particular in each cultural context. In that sense, Catholicity is a mandate for enculturated mission and church. And then reproducing churches is a process that adds something else. It reminds all churches that they came from an outside and yet relational source. They were generated, humanly speaking, either by a founder or by a group from another sending church. They are intentionally and inherently part of something greater than themselves. Say you are a plant, and the question exists, who planted you? So, in such a case, the dimensions of being church across time, apostolic, and this connection across space, Catholicity, meet in an obvious way. So young churches in particular should be very conscious of their wider belonging or Catholicity that gave them birth. And such a birth reminds them of a grace and a gift. They received a life beyond themselves. Rather than, I suggest sometimes particularly maybe true, the North American continent, a focus on our own power and ability. Well, you've been patient. I think you deserve another clip.
Highfield's always been a church that has welcomed students in the past, but the history of what we're doing here at the Living Room has been quite identifying quite a specific need.
And members of Zoe's church in Southampton realised that need was great. Two university campuses on their doorstep, and yet less than 2% of the 40,000 students living there attended local churches.
What we wanted to do here at the Living Room is provide a place that is welcoming, that doesn't feel like preconceptions of church, whatever that is, but somewhere that students can feel like it's their own space, where they're welcome to meet with other people, to be able to ask questions, to be able to chat to people, to come in and to opt out if they want. We have space in the cafe, as it's set up, for people just to sit and chat and opt out. And that makes it less threatening, I think, for people coming with no prior church background.
Hi, I'm Nikki. This is the food part of the Living Room. We feel it's very important as it's initial point of contact when people come in. There's smells and they stand in the line and we welcome them. And it's a very social thing because they come in, sit in the cafe, they can chat, and it's not intimidating.
It's been, you know, a journey getting to where we are with the living room. We had something called Ignite, which was a group of students meeting after our evening service. And we kind of used those foundations, we used the people who were there, that team, that core team, to kind of start something a bit bigger, to start something that was more like church rather than a gathering after church. And in terms of, you know, PCC and those things in the Church of England that we kind of go through, you know, we went to them and they were very aware that there was a need that was greater than we were meeting at the time. And they were very supportive of anything that would encourage more students to come to know the transforming power of Jesus.
I was looking for a church, and the thing I found most attractive about the living room was just the warm nature of the environment. All the lights there, the fact that I got served food here was really great. And I just found the worship and the talks really on my level and really spoke to me. Every week I got something out of it.
I was very nervous, but no, it was really good, really chilled out. No one expected anything of you. It was just a nice place to come, really. You can take part as much as you want or as little as you want. So that was really good.
A couple of our housemates are sort of getting quite asking a lot of questions about it, and they're quite keen to come along to some of the events because everyone's so welcoming and friendly here. It's great to just get involved in however way you can.
Life's hard, that's what their faces say. And then we met these Christians who were living in the same place with the same stuff going on in their lives, the same sort of history, and they've still got really tough lives. But we have to remember in the midst of those times.
People are the best resource, I would say. I mean, I've got a team here of 20 students who are just absolutely wonderful and who come here at 4:30 on a Sunday afternoon and set up and stay until 11:30 at night and kind of take everything down again. The vision for it was to be a place where unchurched students would come and know Jesus. But we didn't ever set out to start it as a congregation. But it certainly has evolved into that. And obviously, along the way, we've had discussions about the implications for our other services, for our main 6:30 service, which has historically been a service where students come to. I think it's quite important for students, particularly in this culture now, to have people mentoring them and people who they're accountable to who are of a similar age, and I'm not pretending that I'm still student age, but I can relate to them. I think people in this culture respond very well to peer-led accountability and mentoring, but obviously I'm part of a greater structure. The line doesn't stop with me. You know, I have somebody who oversees the youth and student work and the vicar here at Highfield who are all around, but as far as my role goes, I think, you know, I probably wouldn't want to be much older than I am. If I was advising somebody on how to start up something that would reach students in their local community, then I would probably recommend that they start by building a team. Build a team of people who are passionate about the vision for reaching students, who have a heart for it, and pray and spend time hearing God. And then to step out, you know, to have big dreams and big goals, to think outside the box a bit, and to start doing things that are more student-friendly. We no longer live in an age where people respond just to words, just to kind of teaching, and people have no prior knowledge of who Jesus is, so you need to really start with something. They want to see something immediate, something tangible. When they see something that is authentic, they want to be part of it. What has been the most exciting thing and a real privilege about being part of the living room is that our vision for seeing unchurched students actually coming and experiencing the transforming power of Jesus is actually happening. God has been working. He's been bringing people along from all sorts of different places, people who've been coming with friends, people who've just turned up as students who aren't Christians, who've been part of our fellowship here, who've been part of the community at the living room, are happy to come along even though they don't actually know really who Jesus is. They don't know why they're here sometimes. And that's our experience, and people have come and they've become Christians as part of what we're doing, and that's just, you know, that's what it's all about. It's really exciting.
Okay, I'm trying to work with you. I suppose trying to be quite rigorous theologically. What actually are these essential things about being church? And the four marks are one way to do that. If in a way I was being a little bit more frivolous, I think I'd say to you there's probably a fifth mark of the church today, and it's this: food. And it would be the case if you looked at many of these other examples that I could show you, and some of them I will be showing to you tomorrow, you'll notice how often food comes in. I think, speaking theologically again, if you just wanted one mark of the church, we could do worse than go to David Watson's book, I Believe in the Church, and his closing chapter, the one mark of the church is love. Relational word, probably food's a relational word too. Anyway, let's finish off what we said we would do, which is holiness and oneness. I want to suggest to you these two are a pair. And holiness enshrines the dimension of how the church lives its existence as belonging to God. Again, when I look to recent authors on the four marks, it seems to me that the language of calling, being set apart, being positively different to the world, but without a world-denying withdrawal, is what they were looking at. That's the vocation of the church. To exist for God becomes the call, then, to become more like God, morally, spiritually. As Dulles puts it, the church must be characterized by holiness, otherwise it could not be a sign of Christ. And our public worship is just one means by which engagement with God leads us, makes it more possible to step into taking on more of his characteristics. But that then needs to be cashed out in discipleship. Be holy as I am holy, says the Lord. Go to church as just rather a poor substitute. Now, having said that, that call to be holy is also going to be always clearer than the realization of that call or the achievement of that call. Dulles, again, links that to the abiding relevance of the church having penitential sections in its liturgy. It's not designed to make guilty people feel worse. It's designed to show us that actually there is a serious call to holiness. The parable of the wheat and the weeds might also be a helpful feature here. So if we're going to talk about any claim to holiness, we have to do it with a very self-aware modesty, as well as an awareness that we're called for a purpose. Because belonging to God and his purposes will connect holiness to apostolic mission. Let me show you how. This emphasis on calling opens up the question of election, with attendant temptations to pride and insularity. Lovely corrective, I think, is supplied by the writings of Niebuhr. He's very consistent across his writings about this, that calling, with all its privileges and its gift, cannot be separated from missional identity. These are his words. They are chosen not for themselves, not to be exclusive beneficiaries of God's saving work, but to be bearers of the secret of his saving work for the sake of all. They are chosen to go and bear fruit. And the reproduction of churches takes that specific calling very seriously, and it embodies a linkage between holiness and apostolicity. Now, I think also this emphasis on holiness has got something quite good to say to us who are interested in church planting. And if you like, it's this: novelty is no substitute for integrity, or character, or spirituality. Doing what is becoming popular or fashionable in the church is no substitute for seeking and hearing the calling of God. Church planting might be brilliant, but if you are not called to do it, please don't. It also tells us, I think, this holiness thing, that worship at any expression of church never should descend to self-indulgence. Whether you express that in classical terms in your Cranmer and Bach, or in contemporary tastes, I don't know, Matt Redmond and All Songs West, or whatever that is, it's not about that. It's about response to God, to be transformed, to becoming more like God, grace and character. So we come to oneness. And I suggest to you this fourth mark complements the third one of holiness. And if holiness is about belonging to God, then oneness is about the dimension of belonging in a similar way like God. And it deals with how the church community understands its internal relationships because of its externally derived identity. And again, common across the contemporary writers on oneness, the deepest source and understanding of those relationships is, guess where, because of how I think, and now you're learning this, the Trinity. And the prayers of Jesus in John 17, that those who follow will be one, Father, as you and I are one. Some interesting reliance, too, in some of the texts on Ephesians 4, and you may know it's seven factors, the seven ones there. I'm going to read them, but accent them to you. One body, one spirit, hope, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father. Do you see? The seven features in themselves have allusion to the members of the Trinity. John Stott, in his commentary, argues that the four remaining qualities are actually dependent on the Trinitarian three. So as he puts it, the Father creates the one family. Jesus creates the one faith, baptism, and hope. The Spirit creates the one body. Now, whether that argument is textually sustainable, whether it's a bit modalistic, okay, fair enough. The Trinitarian base for unity immediately puts diversity on the table beside it. And any view today of unity that disallows diversity has become suspect. The Trinitarian base is very fertile for holding together unity and diversity. I wonder, have you ever asked yourself the question, why do we have the order one, holy, Catholic, and apostolic? Does that wrongly give the oneness a hermeneutical authority over the other three marks? Now, it's arguable that that actually goes back in thinking to the 3rd century North African bishop Cyprian. He was a Roman, he was legal, he lived in a cultural background that deeply prized oneness and singularity. In Cyprian's writings, he actually compares the church to a Roman army camp. And one of the things we know about them is whether they were on Hadrian's Wall or whether they were in Turkey, they were identical. It was a universal uniformity. And so oneness, I suggest to you in the writing of Cyprian, and possibly as an inheritance from him, oneness becomes code for one center, one leader, one form, universal uniformity. Trinitarian understanding recently has profoundly challenged that construct of oneness. And that communal view embraces unity and diversity. Arguments for the necessity of overseas contextualization and indigenization have fueled that fire. The creation of fresh expressions at home has added pragmatic examples of ways of being church that are both different from the inherited and yet clearly still are church. It's as though we all used to be monocultural in our ecclesial world, and we've been forced to realize that there are other cultures that are also valid. Now, such an emphasis on diversity, I think, then creates for some people a bit of a confusing overlap between Catholicity and oneness. In my theological teaching back in England, I find even my M-level students, master's level students, find it quite difficult to retain clear intellectual borders between oneness and Catholicity. Mission Shaped Church happened, I suppose, to follow my suggestion that oneness today deals more with the issue of diversity within a local group of Christians and how they belong together in ways that followed Trinitarian unity and diversity, and Catholicity deals more with wider connections across space and thus the bonds and relationships between groups of Christians in different places and cultures. However, I freely confess that reality is more complex than that. The earliest use of the word Catholic is of a local church and about the wholeness of its life. And at least in theory, the oneness of the church is universal both in time and space. So I'm afraid it is a little bit more untidy than that. So then these four marks remain. Though they continue to be reinterpreted and they clearly interact. Hence my three-sided pyramid diagram that insists they are interconnected dimensions. These, I suspect, are deep in the DNA of church. I do not say that they are everything that might be said, but as a start, as a kind of equivalent to the helix of adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine, my four new children, they are not bad. I want to add this towards the end. I do think that the of, or the Catholic dimension, is usually the base of the pyramid. You see, up and in and out, they're all action words. Of is a being or belonging word. Christians are the body of Christ. Our identity is fundamentally and miraculously to be part of his identity. We are those who are in Christ, and thus we share in his communion with the Father and the Spirit. We join in their mission, and we are re-energized and redirected by encounter with God. I've tried to explore with you DNA as an analogy of what is the essence of church. Let me draw it all together. So then, a group may be called church when a diverse community is formed by transformative encounter with Jesus Christ. Called to follow him, this community lovingly responds through promptings of the Spirit, seeking to live and act as signs of God's kingdom. And their call is to be the people of God for a particular place or culture, and that then will be shown by the emergence of the following. By their present acts and words, they communicate the reality of Jesus continuing his mission, apostolic. By living out faithful commitment to one another, they reflect the loving and diverse oneness of the Trinity, one. Knowing they are an integral part of God's universal people, they love, learn from, and support Christians beyond their own group. They are Catholic. And by their worship of God the Trinity, they encourage transformation into God's holiness, including the practice of attending to Scripture and doing baptism and communion holy. One, holy, Catholic, and apostolic. And I want to end with this, quite a homely picture. I want to end by saying, if we are clearer about the DNA of church, it then becomes more possible to trust the DNA. Let me show you a picture of my wife and myself. Late again. I then want to pose you this very simple question, which, of course, like all good preachers' questions, you cannot answer, which makes you dependent on me, and that's a good thing. And the question is this: tell me, what do our children look like? And of course, you do not know. Unless you've met them, you cannot know. So I'll show you. And reading from left to right, you are looking at Hannah, the eldest, Julian, the youngest, and Martin, the middle one. As you gaze upon their faces, though not quite with as much love as I am able to summon, you will notice certain facial features. You will see whole face shapes. And you look at their parents and you either think, hard luck, or lucky them, or whatever. And as you know them, you will see certain casts of mind. And you say, I think I know where that came from. Looking back, you can see the family likeness. But you also encounter individuality. I dare you to do one round in the ring with any one of them and say you are no more than your parents. Untrue. So it is, I suggest to you, with DNA and all expressions of church. You cannot know exactly what they will be like at the start. But if the DNA is there, and we may have some responsibility to putting it in, hence trying to work through this with you carefully, when they are grown, the parentage will be apparent to those who have eyes to see. And I believe you may trust it.